Hi, and welcome to this week's reading of the New York Times Magazine. I'm Frankie Goldfarb, and for the next hour, I will be reading from the March 31st, 2024 issue. And I'll start with the cover story. It will be our first article. It's titled Reinventing CPR. A new high-tech approach can restart more hearts and save more lives. Why aren't more hospitals embracing it? It's by Helen Oyong. Greg Hayes, an emergency first responder in Chahansen, Minnesota, was picking up takeout sushi when a 911 call came in. A 61-year-old had stopped breathing at home. Hayes and his team jumped in their ambulance and were soon pulling up in front of a suburban two-story house where paramedics and other first responders were also arriving. All of them grabbed their equipment and raced through the open garage to find a man, gray and still, on the living room floor with his wife and stepdaughter nearby. Until that Thursday in August 2022, John Sawyer's most pressing health concern had been his seasonal allergies. After a routine day, a desk job in front of a computer, a 3-mile walk with his wife, some yard work, he was sitting on the couch in front of the television with his wife, Kristen Waters. But when a commercial came on, he didn't mute it as he usually did. Then when his stepdaughter asked him a question about her car, he didn't answer. He rolled his eyes at her instead, and he kept rolling them. Waters, a nurse, checked for his pulse. His heart had stopped beating. She told her daughter to call 911, and the two women struggled to get Sawyer, who is very tall and rather bulky, onto the ground to start CPR. Waters pushed up his sweaty t-shirt to expose his chest and began briskly pushing on his breastbone. She had taught CPR classes, but she had never done it on a real person. Up and down, her fingers interlocked, hand over hand. Sawyer's head bobbled limply around. There I am doing chest compression, she thought, and this CPR is never going to wake him up. When Hayes arrived, he too didn't think there was anything that he or the medics or even a hospital could do to save Sawyer. Not that he wouldn't give it, in his words, the 100% college try. But having been an emergency medical technician for more than 3 decades, he knew how sudden cardiac arrests usually end. Sawyer would probably die. As the clock ticked towards 30 minutes from when Sawyer's heart stopped, the chance of his survival was dwindling rapidly to zero. Hayes began rehearsing in his head what he would say to Waters. He stared at a photo on the wall of Sawyer whitewater rafting with his family. It was gut-wrenching, he said. Worldwide, cardiac arrest, when the heart suddenly stops beating, strikes some 5 million people a year outside of a hospital setting. In the United States, that figure is nearly 400,000. And in 2021, of those who were fortunate enough to have a bystander call 911, and have emergency medical service come to their assistance, only about 9% survived long enough to be discharged from a hospital, a dismal number that has barely budged in decades. Waters was right. She was not going to revive her husband through chest compressions alone. But the chance of survival decreases by 10% for every minute that passes without any CPR at all. And while bystander CPR is by itself unlikely to save anyone, other advanced interventions won't work without it. That's because chest compressions keep blood flowing, however sluggishly, however minimally, to the brain. The defibrillator, a machine that delivers a powerful jolt of electricity to a person's heart, is one of the few 20th century inventions that have helped improve survival rates. Automated defibrillators are sometimes found in places like airports and gyms, and they can be incredibly effective when deployed immediately. Even so, bystanders seldom use them because they don't know how or because they can't find one. Nor can every type of cardiac arrest be helped with a defibrillator. The victim must have what's called a shockable rhythm, and even that may not respond to a shock. In the family's living room, the medics had immediately slapped defibrillator pads onto Sawyer's chest. The machine's monitor displayed a green chaotic scribble, which meant his heart was quivering but not pumping blood, instead of the regular organized pattern that normal hearts produce. Sawyer was shocked twice. He didn't wake up. Hayes remembered that some cases of cardiac arrest were supposed to prompt a call to the doctors at M Health Fairview University of Minnesota Medical Center, instead of being taken directly to the closest hospital. The specialist on call there, Jason Bartos, confirmed that Sawyer was a candidate for a procedure called extracorporeal CPR, or ECPR. Soon after that, a clunky machine that performs automatic chest compressions, called a Lucas device, was strapped around Sawyer's torso for the ambulance ride. By then, his feet had turned a dusky blue. Because the half-hour drive to the medical center would have been too long, the ambulance met an enormous ECPR truck at a midway point. Bartos arrived separately in a hospital-owned SUV. He was already wearing blue scrubs and a University of Minnesota scrub cap. After Sawyer was lifted onto the truck, Bartos and several health workers got in as well. Hayes, eager to watch the ECPR procedure for the first time, joined them. Bartos used an ultrasound machine to find the large vein and artery in Sawyer's right groin, which appeared as black circles on the screen. He placed a needle in each blood vessel, then fed guide wires through the needles. He threaded one long wire into the vein and pushed it up into Sawyer's abdomen and chest with the help of X-rays to see the wire's path until he had maneuvered it into and through Sawyer's heart to reach a big vessel just above it. Another wire was placed in Sawyer's artery. A dilator was temporarily inserted over one wire to create a tunnel. The dilator was then removed and a thick cannula was inserted over the guide wire. This was repeated on the other vessel. Once the cannulas were in place, one in the vein and one in the arteries, tubes that looked like garden hoses, connected them to a machine that began sucking out Sawyer's blood. Inside that device, the blood passed through a membrane that functioned like an artificial lung, and then it was pumped, freshly oxygenated, back into Sawyer's artery to perfuse his body, and most important, his brain. The next day, in the intensive care unit, Sawyer looked bad, as though he were still dead. He had no color, and his toes were still blue. I hope I did the right thing by agreeing to the ECPR procedures, Waters recalls thinking while standing at his bedside. Because if he doesn't come out of it, what if he's stuck on these machines? But over the next few days, Sawyer's eyes started fluttering, half open. When the doctor told him to squeeze his hand, he did. By the fourth day, he really wanted a frozen Coke because the tubes in his mouth made it feel terribly dry. Sawyer spent about a week in the ICU and then left the hospital 12 days after his cardiac arrest. 2 months after his heart stopped, he was back at work, though he had been so bored at home. He wanted to return even earlier. Sometimes people didn't grasp that he had died that day. "No," he would tell them, "I really did." ECPR, Hayes told his colleagues afterward, is the most badass thing I've ever seen in my life. He calls it the highest note of his long career, a treatment for a condition that he had almost always seen ended death. "It changed my perspective," he said. "When I was a medical student, every so often I would find myself riveted by a television or movie scene where a tenacious doctor tries one last time to resuscitate a patient after everyone else has given up. Miraculously, the patient receiving CPR gets his heartbeat back. Sometimes he would even sit up and start talking. Of course, I knew the scenes were exaggerated. Is there any greater drama than seeing a beloved character come back to life? But still, a tiny part of me imagined myself as that emergency doctor, the one who kept doing CPR, administered that final shock, injected the drug that made the difference. As I went through residency training, and eventually as an emergency doctor, I wasn't surprised to see that cardiac arrests don't follow the same narrative in real life as they do on film. Yet I was astonished through the years to discover how spectacularly rare it is for standard resuscitation in the emergency room, with its crew of physicians and nurses, in a facility full of equipment and drugs to revive someone. Unlike those dramatic fictional scenes in which one last action changes everything, the opposite is true off screen. If an intervention doesn't work immediately during standard resuscitation, it's probably never going to work. In reality, by the time a patient without a pulse arrives in the ER, we know what the outcome is going to be. We continue CPR and shock the patient if we can. We insert a breathing tube and connect it to a ventilator. We inject medications, adrenaline, heart rhythm drugs. But these treatments almost always fail. Occasionally, a thready pulse comes back, and then it vanishes again. By this point, the chest compressions may have caved in the patient's sternum, his ribs shattered. His lungs might also start hemorrhaging, blood and mucus filling his breathing tube. We continue the cycle. Compression, drugs, maybe shock, checking for a pulse every 2 minutes. Family members wait with hope and despair, sitting in plastic chairs in bustling hallways outside the resuscitation room. In more recent years, I've been escorting loved ones into the room after a while so they can witness the resuscitation attempt. In every instance that I can recall, they asked us to stop. The futility obvious, the suffering too immense. The few times we coaxed the heart to beat again, the patient almost inevitably dies in the hospital later. Dimitrios Yiannopoulos, an interventional cardiologist and professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School, who created its Center for Resuscitation Medicine, refused to accept that this was the best doctors could do. In 2014, he began performing ECPR, a treatment that was starting to catch on in a few places, mostly in Asia and Europe. To his surprise, patients didn't expect to survive, ended doing well. The following year, he started the first comprehensive ECPR program in the U.S., which diverted many cardiac arrests in the Twin City to his facility, where instead of getting only conventional resuscitation methods, they immediately received ECPR. When a patient in cardiac arrest is placed on an extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, and that's the initials for that are ECMO, that's the name of a machine, ECMO machine, as Sawyer was, the treatment is called ECPR. The type of ECMO intervention used in ECPR provides a full life support, which means it does the work of both the lungs and the heart. Another type of ECMO used on COVID-19 patients helped just with the breathing. ECMO evolved from the heart-lung machines that started being used during heart surgery in the 1950s. Patients could be on them for only an hour or so, because the technology delivering oxygen to the blood would also damage it. In the late 1960s, Robert Bartlett, a surgical resident in Boston, and others started to develop a solution, a membrane that infuses oxygen into the blood and filters carbon dioxide out of it. This became the basis of today's ECMO machine. Later, to treat newborns struggling to breathe, Bartlett used the machine, their last hope, and 80% mortality rates soon flipped to 80% survival rates. Now a professor emeritus at the University of Michigan and known as the father of ECMO, Bartlett also was the first to use ECMO for its heart-like function for a child experiencing difficulties after cardiac surgery. But when a multi-center trial funded by the National Institutes of Health tested ECMO on adults suffering from respiratory failure, the treatment didn't save more lives than conventional care did. Afterwards, critics pointed out the trial's poor design. Different centers relied on different protocols, and some had no ECMO experience. Yet the results published in a prominent medical journal discouraged doctors from trying the intervention. Quote, that set aside ECMO for adult patients for the next 30 years, Bartlett, who had helped the study, told me. But he and others continued using the treatment with babies and then in time with older children as well. The eventual adoption of ECMO for adults was driven, in part, by paramedics. In 2009, doctors, desperate to save patients dangerously ill with H1N1, or swine flu, as it was called, put some of them on ECMO. Many of these patients survived. A decade later, COVID-19 thrust ECMO into the public consciousness. By then, a multi-center study testing ECMO on adults in Britain had shown promising results. Doctors also were successfully using ECMO for certain cardiac cases. ECPR by itself doesn't actually cure anything, but by providing fresh blood flow to the brain and other organs, it lets the body rest and gives doctors time to fix the underlying problem. If it's fixable. Patients whose hearts are in a rhythm that's conducive to being shocked with a defibrillator, like Sawyer's chaotic pattern, fare much better. That's because they usually have a primary heart problem that can be repaired. After patients are hooked up to ECMO, angiograms of their hearts are typically performed to determine whether they have clogged arteries, as about 85% do. In Sawyer's case, Yiannopoulos found a blockage in his largest heart vessel, the left anterior descending artery, also known as the widowmaker. He inserted a stent to open it back up. For others whose hearts have some electrical signals that are not able to beat sufficiently, what's called pulseless electrical activity, which is seen as a flat line. Or if it is found, the problem is it's often too late to fix. The reason ECPR must begin so quickly is to keep the brain perfused with oxygen. And the most common reason people still die afterward is that their brains couldn't recover from the initial reduction in blood flow. ECPR really should be called ECBR, Bartlett says. Complications during the procedure itself are not uncommon. A lot can go wrong when running big cannulas into people's blood vessels, from their groins all the way up to their hearts. Vital vessels can be ruptured, causing catastrophic bleeding. The liver can be lacerated. The heart can be perforated. Or the procedure can simply fail. After a patient is on ECMO, a special catheter needs to be placed in the patient's leg to maintain its blood flow, or it too can die. ECMO machines can cause clots, so a powerful blood thinner is used, which in turn can cause life-threatening bleeding. But the greatest enemy of ECPR, of the brain, really, is the clock. And unlike a stroke, whose treatment window is measured in hours from the start of symptoms, cardiac arrest stops blood flow to the brain, bringing a person closer to death with each passing minute. In Yiannopoulos' program, if patients with a shockable rhythm are started on ECMO within 30 minutes of collapse, there is nearly 100% chance of reviving them with their brain function intact. After 40 minutes, the survival rate falls to about half, and then to around 20% after 1 hour. By contrast, patients receiving standard resuscitation measures have essentially no chance of survival after 40 minutes. So, quote, big picture, ECPR is the most effective intervention for cardiac arrest since CPR. Joseph Tona, an emergency critical care doctor at the University of Utah Health, who researches ECPR, told me, without a doubt. But he acknowledges adversities. It's actually pretty hard to implement. The biggest obstacle for Yiannopoulos in the beginning was proving to his colleagues that patients in cardiac arrest were a population worth fighting for, he said. The nursing staff thought I was experimenting. Marita Sanders, the nurse manager of the cardiovascular ICU in his hospital, told me that when she heard about the program, quote, first thing I thought was, oh my, I gotta figure out who's running this and shut this down. Sanders pictured the ICU filling up with profoundly brain-injured people who would stay for months before eventually being moved to nursing homes. But then she recalls a patient, a middle-aged man whose heart stopped while he was at a pub nearby, woke up after several days in the ICU with all his faculties totally intact. Her mind was changed. Compared with standard resuscitation practice, she said, it's like, wow, we've arrived. Several years after the program started, Yiannopoulos, Bartos, and their team conducted the first randomized controlled trial of ECPR. The results were published in The Lancet in 2020 as the ARREST trial, A-R-R-E-S-T. The study included only patients who had been given bystander CPR, so their brains received some blood flow and had a shockable rhythm, signaling a treatable cause. And only patients who did not wake up from standard EMS resuscitation before they arrived at the hospital. Patients like Damar Hamlin, the Buffalo Bills safety, or Christian Eriksen, the midfielder who plays for Denmark and Manchester United, each of whom collapsed on the field of play and was shocked back to life, didn't need ECPR because the defibrillator did its job. After enrolling just 30 patients, the ARREST trial was stopped early by an NIH board because the patients who got ECPR did so much better than the control group subjects who received standard resuscitation, and it would have been unethical to continue the study. After 6 months, 43% of the 14 patients who got ECPR were alive with good brain function, compared with zero in the control group. One ECPR patient woke up and decided he didn't want to be in this study, so he was excluded from the final count, although he obviously fared well. Walter Panzerer, a trustee of the Hemsley Charitable Trust, had already learned about the program before the ARREST study came out. End quote. It sounded way too good to be true, Panzera said, and he arranged to meet with Yiannopoulos. The night before the meeting, Yiannopoulos sat down in front of his fireplace with a glass of, sounds like fancy scotch, Lagavulin 16, and he asked himself, quote, what would I do if I had all the money in the world? End quote. And what he sketched out on a napkin was the next step in his ECPR revolution, making it mobile. That is, his team would meet patients at local hospitals and perform ECPR there. Once they were connected to the ECMO machine, the countdown clock now stopped. Patients would be driven to the university hospital to receive specialized ICU care. For people who live too far away from a participating hospital, an ECPR truck, fully outfitted like a super-duper cath lab, a state-of-the-art cardiac catheterization facility, would converge with the team at rendezvous sites. The Helmsley Trust gave Yiannopoulos grants totaling $19.4 million, which enabled him to add this hub and spoke mobile component to his program. The university hospital would be the hub, and a truck in some local hospitals would be the spokes. It was a real big bet, Panzera told me. To reach patients in areas that were more suburban and rural, Yiannopoulos first had to team up with surrounding health systems. Competition is more often the norm among health systems rather than collaboration, but he persuaded his chief executive, James Hereford, to gather his counterparts from other institutions. Eventually, they were willing to work together, but they had to sort out a lot more than simply agreeing to collaborate. How would insurers pay for what they were doing? Would the initial hospital get the money, or would the university hospital? Would malpractice coverage protect doctors outside their own institutions? And what about transport? Every question could be turned into a reason for hospital administrators and lawyers to say no. Yiannopoulos would just not let this rest, Hereford says. And an umbrella organization called the Minnesota Mobile Resuscitation Consortium was created to address such questions, and Bartos became its first president. To make the program expansion possible, Yiannopoulos and Bartos had to train other doctors to perform what can be a very difficult procedure. Yiannopoulos is known as an ECPR wizard. When I watched him at work on a cardiac arrest patient recently, his fingers danced between needles and wires and dilators and cannulas with such grace and speed that they were a blur. But what he and Bartos can do in under 5 minutes can take other teams 20 minutes or longer, while also increasing the risk of complications. As Charles Bruin, an emergency critical care doctor who joined the mobile team, explains, quote, where the training really becomes necessary is the thousands of micro skills that have to be done exactly right. Where you place your hands, what you feel is, and how specifically doing all those things. And this is happening as the chest compressions from the Lucas device are bouncing the patient's body around. About a dozen doctors started to learn the procedure, but in part because of its difficulty and also because of pandemic disruptions, all but two ended up dropping out. To assist with the procedure and with setting up the ECMO machine, flight paramedics and nurses already familiar with ECMO were recruited to train for the program. One of Yiannopoulos' most important tasks was teaching and coordinating all the EMTs and paramedics who are first at the scene of a cardiac arrest. Before the Minnesota program was in place, first responders there would often remain where patients collapsed and try to resuscitate them on site. This is known as stay and play. Once ECPR became available, they were encouraged to load and go, to deliver a patient to a specific facility as quickly as possible. To meet them there, the mobile team drives special SCUVs equipped with lights and sirens. Quote, "We go very fast," said Yiannopoulos, who also owns a Ducati motorcycle. "It's like a state trooper going crazy down the roads, and I'm even more crazy." This is a very long article, and I'll stop reading it now so there's time for another article. The next article is called On the Menu, by Marcela Valdez. The globe-trotting humanitarian chef José Andrés has more than a dozen restaurants. A visit to his kitchen at one of his most beloved spots reveals the recipes behind his success. One afternoon this January, I watched the celebrity chef José Andrés flip through page proofs of his newest cookbook called Zaytinya. He had the pages spread out over the glass top of a custom-made football table inside the Washington, D.C. headquarters of the sprawling food group that bears his name. Here, Andrés was like a king in his throne room. The José Andrés Group now directs more than 30 eateries, from a 2-Michelin-starred restaurant to a food truck, as well as retail products, a podcast, newsletters, and television programs. His charitable organization, World Central Kitchen, runs through a separate nonprofit. Yet Andrés' success appeared to bring him little comfort. In his opinion, several of the cookbook's images lacked flair. He didn't like the way the mushrooms were photographed. He thought the octopus Santorini needed more glistening olive oil. He flipped the pages morosely, mumbling to himself, quote, "This one is bad. This one is bad. No, it's next level bad." Others earned his grudging approval. "That's okay. That's okay." Andrés' kingdom rose from the enduring popularity of several Washington restaurants, principally Haleo, Ayamel, Zaytinya, Mini Bar, and China Chilcano. All specialize in small plate menus, a dining concept Andrés pioneered in the 1990s. Many were opened with backing from entrepreneurs Rob Wilder and Roberto Alvarez, and are in Penn Quarter near the National Portrait Gallery. Haleo, a collaboration with the chef Anne Cushon, honors Spanish tapas. Oyamel does Mexican. mini bar serves avant-garde cooking, while China Shilkano dishes out Chinese and Japanese by way of Peru. But the vegetable-centric Zaytinya has become one of the group's most successful restaurants. When it first opened in 2002, its modern interpretation of Greek, Lebanese, and Turkish messy bowled over diners in the capital who were more used to steak and potatoes. On Saturday nights, they would happily wait 2.5 hours for a table. A year later, it was shortlisted for the James Beard Foundation's Award for the Best New Restaurant in America. Today, after almost 2 decades in business, Zaytinya is a kind of institution in Washington, a mid-price gourmet restaurant with dishes that start at $8, serving more than 700 people on a typical weekday and over 1,000 on Saturdays and Sundays. It's where my family takes out-of-town guests. It's where we eat lunch before visiting museums on the mall, where we grab a bite before a show. The pages on the football table contained at-home versions of the dishes that Washingtonians love. There was a recipe for spanakopita, the spinach and feta pie. It's usually served in a square or triangle slice, but at Zaytinya's, it is shaped like an egg roll and pan-fried. There was a recipe for crispy Brussels sprouts, which almost every table seemed to order, sizzling wedges on a bed of garlic confit yogurt topped with lemony bayberries. There were instructions for making Zaytinya's phyllo dough and its cloud-like pita bread. The proofs looked gorgeous to me, but Andres seemed disappointed that they weren't even better. When he reached the last page, though, he seemed to realize the futility of his perfectionism, and he patted the messy pile with resignation. Quote, "But it's a good book, no?" he asked the group's publishing director, Anne McCarthy, who used to be a managing editor at the gourmet magazine Saveur. "It's a great book," she answered. He sighed. Cookbooks rubbed him against his own mortality. He had an office filled with rare volumes, including early editions of Auguste Escoffier's Ma Cuisine, first published in 1934. Irma S. Rombauer's The Joy of Cooking, 1931. And Angel Mora's El Practicon in 1894. He recently traveled around Europe and the Middle East, caring for light reading, a cookbook from the 1700s. Andres had already published 4 cookbooks, but at 54, he was all too aware that with each new volume, it represented a chance to shape how he would be remembered. With Zaytinya, a part of that legacy may be his knack for research and team building. Andres had never even traveled to Greece when Alvarez, who was a vegetarian, suggested that they open a Middle Eastern restaurant. To develop its menu, Andres ate his way through Lebanon, Turkey, and Greece, where he forged a lasting partnership with the cookbook author Agaya Kremesi, who taught him to make Lenten-style dolmades, which are grape leaves stuffed with tomato, pine nuts, and fennels. He learned to make hummus from Grace and Danny Abinyam, whose family owns the restaurant Lebanese Taverna. His process for making phyllo dough came from a gentleman, Hashoush, a Palestinian-Lebanese chef who was one of Zaytinya's original cooks. Andres and his team still make regular pilgrimages to explore the markets, restaurants, and coffee shops of the Eastern Mediterranean, often eating two breakfasts, three lunches, and four dinners in a single day. The heavy lifting for creating Zaytinya, of course, was complete decades ago. Since then, Andres has developed other restaurants outside Washington. He has become arguably more famous for his work on television and with World Central Kitchen, which provides food aid in the wake of natural disasters and violent conflicts, than he is as a restaurateur. But even as restaurants across the United States have shut down, Andres has several in Washington that have survived not only the pandemic and inflation and labor shortages, but also the Great Recession of 2008, helping to transform a neighborhood once blighted by crime and store closures. When they signed the original lease for Zaytinya, Wilder told me, the portrait gallery was closed for renovations and no national restaurant company wanted its location on 9th Street Northwest. And now there's an Hermes store two blocks away. During Zaytinya's early years, Andres haunted the kitchen of his Washington restaurants, working with each head chef and often standing at the pass to expedite dishes. But after the Think Food Group, as it was then named, opened its first restaurant in California, it was no longer possible for him to work in every kitchen. As the public face of an expanding company, he needed not only to establish menus, but also to woo business partners and customers with public appearances. "I feel like I'm a foreigner here," he confessed, as we sat over margaritas at Oyamel. There was a time, he said, when he would have known every person at the host stand. Behind the bar, serving tables, washing pots, mixing guacamole. "I used to be much more of a player," he said, over another round. "Now I'm more the coach. They're the ones on the field." A few days later, he hopped on a plane to make an appearance at an A-list cookout in the Cayman Islands. At Zaytinya, Hilda Mazergos is the person responsible for switching on the lights every morning. She's a middle-aged woman with a ready laugh. She never attended a culinary school. She was on track to become a school teacher in Guatemala when she took the job at a restaurant in Virginia, thinking her work in kitchens would be temporary. 4 months after Zaytinya opened, she was hired as a line cook on the fry station. She went on to master every other station in the kitchen: salad, saute, grill, oven, flat top, bread, and dessert. And now she's the restaurant's executive sous chef. She can make each of the signature dishes from scratch and has trained most of the cooks. Many have worked at Zaytinya for more than 5 years. "I've been there for 13 months, the head chef, Terry Nottis, told me, and I'm still the new guy. On the Thursday that I came to visit, I found her in Zaytinya's closet-sized chef office, working on the next week's schedule. About 25 cooks and dishwashers are in the kitchen during each shift. And at 8 in the morning, the space already hummed with the sound of staff members scrubbing down surfaces with soapy water. In the prep kitchen, Antonia Makuk, who was born in Guatemala, had been working at Zaytinya for about a decade, and he was trimming 80 pounds of chicken, saving the spare bits so they could be added to stock. The beauty of this food is that everything is made like you make family food at home, I was told in Spanish, which is still her preferred language. Nearly every dish is made from scratch daily, which requires skill and attention. There are machines that make dolmades, for example, but at Zaytinya, they are filled and rolled by hand by a woman from El Salvador, Julia Hernandez, who produces them by the thousands each week. She also makes the restaurant's juicy kippah, a football-shaped cinnamon spice meatball that is encased in a crusty shell of bulgur wheat and ground beef. That Thursday morning, Marzeros made a batch of phyllo using the technique that she learned two decades ago. She flattened a dozen baseball-sized rounds of dough into single sheets, each larger than a pillowcase. And then she layered these together with handfuls of cornstarch and ran a rolling pin over the stack until it turned into one thin, silky sheet nearly the size of a throw blanket. Quote, "This is my workout," she joked, as she flipped the phyllo for the fourth time using a long wooden dowel and then rolled it even thinner. Phyllo made this way is more elastic than the kind sold in stores, so Zaytinya can stuff it with more spinach and shape it into a cylinder for spanakopita. Michael Costa had no experience cooking Greek, Turkish, or Lebanese food when he was hired in 2010 to begin what would be an 11-year run as Zaytinya's head chef. Quote, "Hilda trained me," he explained over lunch. When he told Andres that he was nervous about his inexperience, Andres said not to worry. The way Zaytinya worked, it wouldn't matter. It took me a really long time to understand that, to really, really understand what he meant by that, Costa said. It's a village of talented people who have contributed over the years, documenting and standardizing what we do so that it can be consistent. Local diners like their favorite dishes to remain unchanged. So Zaytinya's cooks, most of them Spanish-speaking immigrants, excel at consistency. As they skewered kebabs, roasted eggplants, and heated the base for the slightly pine-flavored mastic ice cream, nobody needed instructions. They just churned out enormous quantities of excellent food without a fuss. Quote, "There's a shared understanding," said Costa, who is now Zaytinya's concept chef. He and Andres often swap ideas just by texting each other photographs. "He's in my head, in my bones," Costa said, "whether I want him there or not." Andres himself no longer spends much time worrying about Zaytinya. His mind is more consumed with other projects and challenges, not all of them happy. Quote, "You are catching me now. In one of those little low points in the last 23 years of my life, he told me in his office, as we drank kava cocktails laced with cherry blossom bitters. Over the last 2 years, he spent more than 100 days in Ukraine, weeks in post-earthquake Turkey and post-hurricane Mexico, days witnessing the horrors of Gaza. 7 volunteers for World Central Kitchen had been killed in Ukraine. His daughters were growing up and leaving home, and his business nearly sank during the pandemic, in part because the Jose Andres Group decided to keep all its restaurants' employees on the payroll for 6 weeks during mandatory shutdowns. The only way for the company to survive afterwards, for the partners to dilute their ownership and take on additional investors. Everything happens to you at once, Andres said, and every time you meet more people and you have a phone filled with WhatsApp messages that you don't have time to answer. He showed me some. Among the texts from friends and families were hundreds from World Central Kitchen's outposts in Japan, Lebanon, Gaza, Israel, and Ukraine. Image after image of crises around the world. No wonder he felt a wave of dismay as he stared at a glossy photograph of mushrooms. He was in a better mood when we talked again several days later, but he admitted he often felt grumpy lately. Quote, I don't know. Maybe with the things that are wrong in the world, I'm getting very anxious that we're not fixing them quick enough, he said. I don't even want people around me, he added. I want to go and feel free. You know, when I'm in Gaza, I feel free. When I go to Turkey and I'm going around, I feel free. But I've been making sure that the restaurants are well run, too. So, in part, you could say, I've been very selfish in giving the Costas of the world, this is yours, because I've been getting my freedom to do other things. Because I've been running restaurants now for a long time. Zaytinya does run well without Andres around, thanks to its village of chefs, managers, and administrators. Last year, a new Zaytinya opened inside a Ritz-Carlton hotel in New York City. This year, another opened inside the Ritz-Carlton in South Beach, Florida, and a third is slated for Las Vegas and another for Palo Alto, California. The expansion has been spearheaded by the group in 2020, and the head chefs at the new locations are supervised by Costas. Well, that's it for this week's reading of the New York Times. I've been reading from the March 31st, 2024 issue. I'm Frankie Goldfarb. Have a great day, and thanks for listening to Chris.